Hello, and welcome to Science World. This past week, NASA unveiled its plans to capture, move, and someday visit an asteroid. Roseanne Skirbo will tell us about a new ultra-high-resolution brain model that's providing scientists with an invaluable tool to better understand brain form and function. And a recent study from the University of Colorado that suggests a change of diet 3.5 million years ago may have paved the way for ancient hominid species to become more human. The lead author of the study joins us later in our program. This and more are coming up for you on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. NASA says its proposed asteroid capture mission takes several of the U.S. Space Agency's ongoing initiatives and aligns them for one major mission. Suzanne Presto has the latest about the proposal to capture, move, and ultimately visit an asteroid.
Asteroids. These chunks of ancient space rocks hold clues about the formation of the universe, pose threats to our planet, and present new territory for explorers. NASA's proposed asteroid mission is a logical next step for the space agency, says Associate Administrator for Human Exploration and Operations, Bill Gerstenmaier.
It essentially fits right with what we were doing already. This whole mission activity captures a lot what we were doing before. It captures the observation things, it captures the electric propulsion, and it captures and utilizes our Orion and SLS just as it was envisioned.
Astronomers already are identifying and tracking near-Earth asteroids in an attempt to find potential threats, which will help as NASA chooses a target. And the space agency's engineers are working on propulsion technologies that use sunlight to efficiently produce low thrust, reducing the amount of propellant needed for such a mission.
We're going to capture and redirect a 7 to 10 meter, approximately 500 ton, near-Earth asteroid to a stable orbit in translunar space, probably a deep retrograde orbit around the moon. And this will enable an astronaut mission to the asteroid as early as 2021.
A successful mission would show that humans can alter an asteroid's path and be useful if one is found to be a danger to Earth. NASA says there is no threat to our planet if something goes wrong during this capture mission, because an asteroid this size would disintegrate before it struck the planet. Gerstenmaier says lunar orbit is stable enough that the asteroid possibly could stay in place for a century.
So once we get the spacecraft and the object in this orbit, it's there for us to go visit multiple times in the future.
Astronauts could use the Space Launch System and Orion space capsule that are being developed. Space explorers could spend about 5 days near the asteroid and venture out of the Orion capsule to collect samples that would be returned to Earth. Gerstenmaier says this will give astronauts and mission control experience working in deep space, far from Earth and the International Space Station.
In this case, we're going to have to make sure we have the right abort scenarios, the right redundancy in place that we can tolerate being in this situation for up to 5 days. So that helps us take a step towards the bigger missions that we want to do going forward.
Bigger missions, such as a manned voyage to Mars in the 2030s. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
Now, a bit of a side note regarding NASA's planned asteroid program. The U.S. House Subcommittee on Space held a hearing this past week and released a Republican-authored draft of NASA's proposed budget that's supposed to begin on October 1st. Their proposal seeks to cut out NASA's asteroid program completely in favor of increased space exploration, including manned missions to the moon, Mars, and, according to the draft, beyond. Now, keep in mind that Congress's plans for NASA is at an early stage at this point and that it must still go through a number of other steps and counterproposals. Plus, President Obama will need to sign off on it before it becomes law. By the way, NASA's asteroid program was outlined by the Obama administration in this year's budget request. Meanwhile, in other space news this past week, a Chinese astronaut orbiting some 340 kilometers above Earth gave a live video lesson on gravity to school children in China. Science World's Bob Doty has more.
Wang Yaping, China's second female astronaut, is one of three crew members sent into space last week on the Shenzhou 10 spacecraft. She delivered her lecture from the Tiangong 1 experimental space lab, which China views as a prototype for a full-fledged space station. Wang participated in a question-and-answer session with students in a Beijing school and also conducted a series of experiments demonstrating how objects react in zero gravity. This is Bob Doty for Science World.
In In the poorest nations and towns around the world, children from the most impoverished homes are twice as likely to acquire malaria as kids from affluent households. From London, Selah Hennessy has more on the findings of a new study published this week in the Lancet Medical Journal.
Researchers say the study, led by Britain's Durham University and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, suggests that alleviating poverty could protect children from malaria. Durham University professor Steve Lindsay led the research. He says that the study highlights a possible new approach to tackling the often fatal mosquito-borne disease.
What's novel about this is thinking about malaria not just through getting bed nets out or better medicines, but we can actually improve or reduce malaria by assisting development in these communities.
The research published on Wednesday is based on an analysis of nearly 5,000 English language studies published over the past three decades. Those studies were conducted in poor communities in Africa and Asia, focusing on children up to the age of 15. The youngsters were ranked by several factors, including family assets, such as whether they have access to a bicycle or radio, levels of education, and skill sets. By linking levels of malaria to socioeconomic status, the research finds that the poorest people are hit the hardest. As an example, Lindsay explains how inadequate housing impacts the spread of malaria.
80% of malaria transmission occurs indoors at night. So if you have a nice house where it's not so leaky, you've got screening on the doors, you may have ceilings, better house, you'll get fewer mosquitoes coming indoors.
He says other development factors also play a role, like eating a nutritious diet or having an education, which helps people make informed decisions about malaria prevention. Lindsay says the study is an attempt to unite the scientific and development communities so that the two can work together to tackle malaria.
So we're being a wee bit provocative here with our hypothesis that, first of all, scientists need to go out and look at what are the mechanisms for where development in its broad sense is protective. And then actually look at ways of intervening, so better housing, better education, helping to improve the general wealth of communities, and how might that impact and reduce malaria.
More than 2.5 billion people are at risk of malaria. The disease is endemic in more than 100 countries around the world. Selah Hennessy for VOA News, London.
It's time once again for the Science World Quick Quiz. We just heard about NASA's ambitious plans to lasso and visit an asteroid. Now, most of the asteroids in our solar system can be found in an area known as the asteroid belt that's located between the orbits of two planets. From the following, what are those two planets? Is it A, Jupiter and Saturn, B, Mars and Earth, or C, Mars and Jupiter? Do you think you have the right answer on this? Well, stick around. The correct answer is coming up in just a little bit. The nooks and crannies of the human brain are now on display in 3D, offering scientists an invaluable tool in the quest to better understand brain form and function. Roseanne Skirbel takes a closer look at the ultra-high resolution reference brain.
The project is called Big Brain. In three dimensions and intricate detail, it reveals the anatomy of the brain as never seen before.
These are images of a 3D reconstructed human brain with a spatial resolution of 0.02 millimeter. So this is even thinner than a thin human hair, and it allows to see the microstructure of the human brain in 3D space.
Katrin Amundst is director of the Vogt Institute for Brain Research at the Heinrich Heine University in Germany, a partner in the project.
Since we would like to understand the relationship between the structure of the brain and its function and, last but not least, behavior, it is necessary to have all the reference brains which have this very high microscopic resolution, and therefore created such reference brain.
The Big Brain model on Emmons' computer screen belonged to a 65-year-old woman who had no neurological problems. To create it, the researchers first cut the brain into 7,400 slices, each 20 micrometers thick, then stained each slice with a special dye so all the cell bodies were visible. After that, the slices were digitized and carefully realigned. Alan Evans at McGill University's Montreal Neurological Institute was in charge of the digital reconstruction. He says it was an arduous task.
This involved us in both manual activity, shifting pieces, broken pieces of the data into the right spatial location, and then a large amount of computational analysis, which allowed us to overcome the distortions, both geometric and optical, to reassemble the data into a coherent three-dimensional form.
The resolution on the reference brain is 50 times greater than the standard brain scans currently available. Its images allow scientists to better visualize what's happening in certain areas of the brain. Big Brain paves the way to understanding how the brain's anatomy contributes to language learning and other processes, or how its shape relates to chemical signaling or gene expression. Katrin Amon says Big Brain offers, for example, a platform to measure the thickness of the cerebral cortex, which changes as one ages and has been associated with neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's.
So having a gold standard, reliable data, how thick the cortex is indeed is, will help to perform such studies in humans, in living human subjects, where the cortical thickness is also measured.
Katrin Amon says access to Big Brain is free online and will be available to the public. Her team is now at work on two more model brains that capture even more details of individual cells. The research was published in the journal Science. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
The recent disclosure of extensive U.S. government surveillance of phone and internet communications has raised many questions, such as, how is it possible to sift through the mountains of data? It turns out that the government was collecting only so-called metadata, as George Putich explains.
U.S. government officials say the surveillance covered only metadata, the patterns of the phone calls and internet messages, not the substance of the communications. According to reports, a majority of email messages sent during a specific time period was intercepted and the metadata stored for possible later analysis. Bill Supernor is the chief technology officer with internet security firm CoolSpan. He says metadata can provide valuable information for intelligence services.
Metadata is a generic term used to describe information that describes information. So the metadata of an email may be who it was sent to, who it was from, the date, what size the message is. Many emails will pass through a number of different hops, a number of different email relay stations, and that kind of information may be regarded to be metadata.
Supernor says that storing metadata requires considerably less space than storing the content of those messages and is much easier to index and catalog, but its usefulness is limited. Phone conversations also carry metadata, including which cell tower the phones used, when a call started and ended, and the position of the caller right down to the city block. Those bits of information can help police and intelligence agencies track criminals and terrorists. But internet messages can also help hackers who may be after financial and other personal data.
The best thing you can do to defend yourself is pick random passwords. So nothing that involves your cats or dogs or car or, you know, the names of any of these things, your address, your family, any of the kinds of things that appear in social media is such a weapon in the hand of the bad guys.
In the case of cell phones, Supernor says never use them to send valuable information such as social security or personal identification numbers or credit card numbers.
SMS is something I would not use for exchanging secure information. That transport is just not a safe transport to use for that kind of information.
Bill Supernor says the internet is not a secure means of communication and strongly advises encryption of messages containing sensitive information. This is especially true for commercial companies and organizations that want to make sure that the private information they share stays behind an impenetrable screen. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World.
A new World Bank study says trends in global warming could roll back decades of development and worsen poverty in some of the world's poorest regions in South Asia, Southeast Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
From declining food production to water shortages, more extreme heat waves to floods, the picture painted by the new World Bank report is grim. The report called Turn Down the Heat follows up on an earlier study that said the Earth could be warmer by 2 degrees centigrade in the space of one generation and by 4 degrees by the end of this century if action is not taken to reduce carbon emissions. Today, temperatures are 0.8 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. The report focuses on the impact of such warming in the regions that will be hardest hit: South Asia, Southeast Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa. It says that in Sub-Saharan Africa, warming by 2 degrees centigrade will significantly reduce crop yields, impacting food security. Loss of savanna grasslands will threaten pastoral livelihoods. In South Asia, the monsoon will become unpredictable, and the region could suffer more extreme droughts and floods. Water in major river basins such as the Indus and the Ganges will reduce further, impacting food security for some 63 million people. Coastal cities such as Kolkata and Mumbai in India and Bangladesh are potential impact hotspots threatened by floods due to rising river and sea levels. And across Southeast Asia, rising sea levels, more intense and tropical cyclones, and loss of marine ecosystems will adversely impact rural livelihoods. The World Bank country director in India, Ono Rule, says the impact of global warming will fall hardest on the poor.
I think the real point to us is that the poor are even more vulnerable than the not so poor, because they're simply less able to protect themselves. So that's the sad part of the story. The most vulnerable get hit the most.
The World Bank is urging individuals and governments to make all choices through a climate lens and work toward aggressive national carbon emission reduction targets. Officials say individuals, for example, should buy the most energy-efficient gadgets instead of those that look the glossiest. Rule says climate change is getting higher on the list of priorities of policymakers in India and other countries, but much more remains to be done.
I think most governments, when you talk to them about it, they will recognize it's a problem. When they make daily choices, they do the same we do with the refrigerator. They just buy whatever looks the glossiest. And I think that's where the challenge is.
The report calls for countries to take urgent action to build resilience through climate-smart agriculture, flood defences, drought and heat-resistant crops, improved groundwater management and coastal infrastructure. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Okay, let's see if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. Today we wanted to know the location of the asteroid belt where most of our solar system's asteroids reside. From the following, is it between the orbits of A, Jupiter and Saturn, B, Mars and Earth, or C, Mars and Jupiter? The answer is C, Mars and Jupiter. As the solar system was forming billions of years ago, a new planet was trying to take shape from a collection of material located between their orbits. But because of the strong gravitational forces produced by Mars and Jupiter, the new planet was unable to come together in a solid, unified form and remained as a band of smaller, rock-like objects in an area of space commonly called the asteroid belt. Thanks for playing this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week. A recent study led by University of Colorado professor Matt Sponheimer has provided a fresh new glimpse into what our human ancestors ate. The study revealed a big change in diet some 3.5 million years ago. That's when some hominid species added grasses and non-flowering plants to their menus, playing a key role in helping our ancestors survive and evolve. On today's one-on-one segment, we talk with Professor Sponheimer, who tells us about the research and findings behind this study and how changes in diet may have set our ancient ancestors on the path to becoming human.
You know, there are various reasons that we're interested in this kind of thing. For one, a lot of people think that a number of modern health issues or result from our diets being somehow out of sync with our biology. So we want to know about the diet of our ancestors. So what we've found now, and we've actually found a lot of different things because there's no such thing as one hominid diet. We're finding a plurality. We're finding a variety of things. But one of the key elements of this new study is that by about 3.5 million years ago, many of our ancient kin were getting some of their dietary carbon from maybe tropical grasses or sedges or perhaps some succulent vegetation. That's very different from what we observe in living apes and very significant from our standpoint.
What was this, Professor, that I was reading about eating like tree bark?
Well, you know, we really know very little about whether or not any of these ate tree bark. It wouldn't be shocking. A number of primates eat tree bark from time to time. Certain aspects of it are actually relatively nutritious, and at certain times of the year when there's not a lot of good stuff around, you'll go for what you can get. In terms of what I suspect you're referring to with some of the earlier work done and that I was involved with, Australopithecus sediba, and there was evidence of phytoliths, some evidence from something like wood or tree bark, but we can't really say whether or not that was something that they were consuming or they're using wood as toothpicks. It was interesting, but it's not something that we can say, okay, this is the exact dietary behavior in which they were engaging.
How were you and your colleagues able to discern what the hominids ate?
That's really what this is all about at the end of the day, is sort of technical development. Over time, people have tried to get at the diet of our ancient hominid ancestors through a variety of means. One, you can look at the size and the shape of teeth, right? If you look at the teeth of a lion and a gazelle, you don't have to be a scientist to know that they probably eat very different things. It tells us something fairly profound about their diets. You can also look at things that are invisible to the naked eye, but the microscopic pitting and scratching on teeth. And that tells us a lot about the meals before death. What we are most interested in here, though we're always hearkening back to those other types of evidence, is actually the variety of carbon that are locked in their teeth. You really are what you eat, at least to a point. So the traces of meals that you eat while your teeth are forming are essentially locked there permanently. And the same goes for organisms that lived several million years ago.
Why do you and your colleagues consider this to be an important finding?
Well, one of the things that we're interested in is how did we become who we are today? We've long known that some of our earliest relatives had jaws and teeth that were very different from extant apes like chimpanzees. But we didn't really know why that was. Obviously, it seemed diet was implicated. But, you know, you want to get beyond, well, there's some sort of important dietary change. You want to try to know what that dietary change may have consisted of. One of the things that our study suggests is that things like grasses or sedges could have been behind some of these changes in the anatomy of our lineage and the kinds of things that distinguish most of these hominin species from one another. And there's still a long way to go before we really understand what was going on, but we're in much better shape than we were a couple of years ago on this. I think we also now have strong evidence through our study and others that these early human ancestors used the landscape very differently than do living apes, and that this may have been a really important step in our becoming human, a different way of interacting with our environment fundamentally.
Since we're talking about a period of a number of years, we know that there is often changes in things such as climate and conditions. What was the impact of a changing climate and various conditions for hominids on things like their diet?
The problem is, of course, as it often is in science, that we don't really know how these changes in climate and environment impacted the diets of human ancestors. Most of us believe that there was an impact of some sort, but establishing exactly what it was is very complicated. I think from our data, you could argue at a very general level that as the environments became more grassy, more grass-like foods were consumed. And I think that would be consistent with our data set. But I also think that this is a partial truth at best. As if you look more deeply at what we have, we see that while there may be evidence of this in some hominin species, other early human ancestor-type creatures show no evidence at all through time, as when we know there were changing environments. So this is one of those questions that is a great one, and it's one of the things that we'll be focusing on in the years ahead. The bottom line with all of this is we really don't have all the answers. We can't put together a specific menu for early hominin diets. But this is really, to my mind, it clearly has taught us a great deal about the past and, in fact, present. And we know a whole lot more than we did a few years ago. And most of the time, frankly, it's a heck of a lot of fun.
That was Dr. Matt Sponheimer, a professor of anthropology at the University of Colorado in Boulder. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.